this is tape 4 of the upper level material on TROM, and tape 4 on the subject of sensations. And this tape, just like its predecessor, must not be detached from the set. Alright, now so much for the identification factor. Now let's take up the subject of motionlessness. Now, because of its postulate structure, where each postulate is bonded to a negative, TIPM has no residual urge to move. However, you could always move the stuff around by pulling at it or pushing at it. But it must bear in mind that left to its own devices, it's quite motionless because of its postulate structure. And another one of its motion qualities is that once it is in motion, because it has no motion of its own, once it is in motion, it tends to stay in motion until it's stopped. So that's another quality of TIPM. Once you do get the stuff on the move, it stays in that state on the move, because there's nothing inside it to prevent itself from moving. Just another one of its qualities. All right, so much for the motionlessness. Now, timelessness. Now, timelessness is actually a time stop. The time actually stops in the TIPM at the point where the TIPM formed. Remember, I discussed this when we were talking about insanity, at the point where the person goes insane. The time stops for them at that point where they go insane. Well, similarly with the TIPM at the barrier. If you were to get right inside of a particle of TIPM, the time actually stopped at the moment where the TIPM formed. So it's the point of genesis of the where the TIPM formed is to be found, if you were to examine the very, very carefully, the little individual packages of TIPM at the boundary. You get that? That's where the time stopped. But nevertheless, there's a timelessness. We can use the word timelessness there. There's a timelessness in TIPM. But bear in mind, it's really a time stop. It's really a time stop. There's a stop time there at the point where the TIPM formed. Although the TIPM by itself contains it's timeless. It's on a time stop. Contains no urge to no time postulates. It can be you can infuse it with a time postulate and make it persist in the universe, a persistency postulate. You can make it endure with a persistency postulate, so forth. So it can be made to persist by endowing it with a time postulate, like any other creation in the universe can. Okay, so much for that. Now the subject of mass. Now, TIPM is perceived as mass. It's always perceived as mass while the viewer either refuses or is unable to perceive its exact postulate structure. Now, how about the solidity of, that is a quality of mass, how about the solidity of the TIPM? Well, that really is a separate postulate. Solidity in this universe is a function of how much importance you assign to a mass. In other words, those things that are regarded as important tend to persist to become more solid. You remember that little postulate there in the universe? So from that point of view, its solidity will depend upon how much importance you assign to the TIPM. Or also, solidity of course can be a direct postulate in this universe. You can make a thing solid by a direct postulate. So you can always make TIPM solid by postulating that it's solid. The subject of the mass there. So I'd like to give you a reading from one of my research notes on this subject, because I don't think I can improve upon them. So I'll give you a direct reading from my old research notes. TIPM, talking about the mass effect of TIPM, etc., and the various qualities of TRPM. TRPM is therefore completely malleable. It's completely passive, like putty. It can be stretched, pushed, pulled, and moulded into any desired shape. It can also be moved around and will stay where you put it, or remain in a state of motion, if motion be imparted to it. TIPM can also be endowed with any postulates or significance you care to put into it. If you call it a stone, it's a stone. Because its passive structure is IPs, whose postulates cancel each other out, it is quite natural. It is quite neutral in terms of postulates. So it can be endowed with any postulate you care to put into it. Today you mould it into a stone. Tomorrow you powder it and mould it into house bricks and make a wall out of it. TIPM is exactly analogous to child's modelling clay. Just as a child can play games with his clay, so a spiritual being can play games with TIPM. If you take a mass of TIPM and leave it in space, close to another mass of TIPM and go away, when you return, the two masses will have moved together. Why? The bonding forces on the surface of the TIPM ensure that this will happen. The same forces that causes each element of TIPM to bond with other elements to form a mass of TIPM will cause separate masses of TIPM to come together if left undisturbed. TIPM has a gravitational effect upon other TIPM, and it all tends to come together into one lump. As we discover these things, we more and more see the similarities between TIPM and the mass of this universe. Indeed, they are identical. TIPM also shows the phenomena of condensation. Once a mass of TIPM is made to continue through time, it manifests a tendency to condense. The phenomena of condensation is due to a decay of the IP postulate structure, causing the mass to literally collapse in on itself. It collapses, it becomes more dense. We call this collapse condensation. Condensed TIPM is collapsing TIPM. The process is continuous, and the degree of collapse is a measure of the age of the TIPM. These are the known qualities of TIPM. There are no doubt many others. That's the end of the direct quote from my old research notes. So we do have in this in our understanding of TIPM and the IP state and the anatomy of sensation, we do have an understanding of where all this mass in the universe came from. One of the, when you start to do research into the human spirit and the human psyche, one of the great puzzles is where all the mass in this universe comes from. It is obviously not created mass. If all the mass in this universe was a mock-up, look, supposing it was mocked up by God, supposing God mocked up all the mass in this universe. Now, you would only have to then say as a spiritual being that this is God's mock-up, and that would be the truth of the matter, wouldn't it? And the mass in the universe would start to thin down, would start to fade out, because that would be the truth. You would be calling the truth of the matter, and so the lie would vanish, you see. If you said it was your mock-up and it was really God's mock-up, then of course that's a lie, and that would tend to make it persist. I refer you to Ron Hubbard's axioms, axiom 11. But we can go around and look at the mass of this universe and say it's God's mock-up, it's Joe's mock-up, it's my mock-up, it's Charlie's mock-up. It doesn't make a slightest bit of difference whose mock-up you assign it to be. It doesn't alter the quality of the mass of the universe in the slightest. So therefore, it is not created mass. Now that's one thing you learn on the research route when you're researching life and mass in this universe, that it is not created mass. And I knew this some years ago. I knew that the mass in this universe is not created mass. I knew that years ago, 20 years, 30 years ago, I knew that. It couldn't be. But I didn't know what it was. But now I'm got into TROM and found out what it is. It's TIPM, which is not created mass. It's generated mass. And now we understand these various qualities of TIPM, we can see how the mass in the universe comes about. And because it's malleable like putty, it can be changed from one state to another. We can get a cloud of particles there which can condense into a gas cloud, and the sun can form, and then the particles can be changed into energy particles and go out and condense again and change into another state. And we see that all the laws of physics and the formation of the life and creation of suns and the death of suns, and it's all TIPM going through its various condensation states. And games can be played in this universe by spiritual beings with this remarkable stuff called TIPM, and all the games that they play generates more sensation, and the sensation then starts to that generates between their opposing postulates then starts to condense down and become tiny particles, which goes in and becomes the mass of this universe and keeps the universe going. It's a self-perpetuating machine, you see. The game played by the spiritual beings in the universe keep the universe provided with new TIPM. The old TIPM goes through a condensation cycle and starts off high on the tone scale, you might say, and ends up as dead matter in some black hole in space somewhere, and becomes unusable anymore in games play by spiritual beings. But not to worry, the universe is expanding, and there's always plenty of games going on between the spiritual beings and generating and creating more and more TIPM by their very games, which is now condensing into more and more so-called mass in the universe. It's quite a game, isn't it? It's quite a game. It's quite a system. And when you understand it, you see the beauty of the system. So So I can assure you that this is the way it is. That when you're looking at the mass of this universe, don't kid yourself. It's all sensation mass. There isn't anything else here. Oh, I wouldn't be dogmatic as that, but I would say that 999.9999% of the mass in this universe is sensation mass condensed, and the other 0.0001% is somebody's mock-up, maybe yours, maybe mine, but that is a very tiny proportion, very tiny proportion. When this universe first started, almost the only mass in this universe was created mass. But at this late stage in the universe, the vast proportion of mass in the universe is TIPM, is mass that's being generated in games play. You know, you can imagine the beings at the beginning of this universe, that they started to play games and this TIPM started to generate at the boundary between their games, and they looked at it and they put it to one side, and after a while it began to pile up in heaps, and then they called in the disposal truck to take it away, and then the truck used to come around and take it away, and then they ran out of places where to put it, and the stuff became an absolute menace, and every time they played games they generated more TIPM, until one day somebody had a bright idea, said, look, instead of trying to dispose of this stuff, why don't we use it in games play? So they started to use it. The beings started to use the TIPM. And then the cycle was complete. Now they could play games with the TIPM, and their games generated more TIPM, and that way they ensured the perpetuation of the universe, of the game of the universe, forever. The snake was now round in a loop and was now biting its own tail. The loop was complete, and the universe could now go on forever. And know this about this universe. When this universe was created, no poster was ever made to say when it will end. I've never come across any poster. Ron Hubbard never came across any poster which said that the universe is going to end at a certain time. It's an open-ended universe, time-wise, this one is, and it goes on forever. And if you're in it, if you're in this universe, you've got two choices. You're either going to jog along with it forever, or you're going to find your way out, and find your way out. And the only way you're ever going to get out is to understand it. There ain't no other routes out. And it's an open-ended universe. It isn't going to stop. So the choice is yours, really. Just to round this off, I would like to give you the postulate configuration, the basic postulate configuration of TIPM. Bear in mind it's formed in a Gold package between the opposing postulates in a Gold package. So in terms of that Gold package, let's call it the XY Gold package, the anatomy and the logical structure of TIPM, not the anatomy but the logical expression of TIPM is X bracket 1 minus x, end of bracket, plus y, bracket, 1 minus y, end of bracket, equals 1. That is the logical structure there of TIPM in terms of the XY postulates of the XY Goals package. That's the general case. Are there any other postulates active upon the TIPM? And so affecting this logical configuration? No, there aren't. The games player may have made various other postulates, but bear in mind the formation of the TIPM is in these little tiny parcels at the barrier. So the only forces acting upon the TIPM are the forces I've mentioned in its generation. So there aren't any other postulates in the set. The what I've just given you, the x bracket 1 minus x end of bracket plus y bracket 1 minus y end of bracket equals 1, is the full and complete expression of the logical anatomy of TIPM. Okay. Right, that takes us to the end of the subject of TIPM and sensations, but I want to take up an allied subject, which really does belong in the same department, you might say, as the subject of TIPM and sensations, and that is the subject of the E-meter. The E-meter in general, but more particularly, more specialised, the moves of the E-meter and the significance of the various needle movements on the E-meter. Now, let me say at once that Ron Hubbard wrote a book on the subject, and he's made many talks on the subject. Ron's ideas on what the E-meter read and so forth were correct as far as they went. There's no doubt about that. No doubt about that. What Ron Hubbard said on the subject is correct as far as it went. His ideas on what caused the E-meter to move are true, as far as they went. And the ideas that you read of and so forth in the psychiatric and the psychological magazines when they talk about people, their hands sweating, and to do with the synapses on the right hand side and the left hand side of the brain, this is just garbage. It really is garbage. Ron was on the right track. He didn't get all of it. Ron didn't get all of it, unfortunately. But what Ron did get on the subject of the E-meter was right. Was right. If you follow what Ron said, he won't put you wrong on the subject of an E-meter, of what it actually is reading and what it actually is recording. What he said is right as far as it went, but he didn't get all of it. Now, with Tron, we can add the rest. We can put the rest that Ron didn't get. The E-meter needle, in essence, simply reads on postulates. That's all it reads. It reads postulates and postulate configurations. There. Now, Ron said it read on mass. Well, what is mass in this universe but a postulate configuration? So Ron was right when he said it read on mass. You get it? But Ron didn't know that mass consists of a postulate configuration. Well, we do know that. We know that a mass is TIPM. We know that. So we know what it's reading on. So when Ron said it read on a mass, he was quite right. It does, it reads on a mass, but basically it's reading on a postulate configuration. So the E-meter really reads on postulates. That's all it reads. It's only postulates that cause that needle to move. It's the postulates and changes of postulates that cause the needle to move. Now, if you understand that, you understand what makes an E-meter needle move. It's got nothing to do with sweat. It's got nothing to do with neurons. It's got nothing to do with synapses. It's got nothing to do with hemispheres of the brain. It's got nothing to do with psychons. It's got nothing to do with anything you'll find in a modern university course on the subject of psychology or any other rubbish of this nature. The E-meter moves on postulates. Get that? You got that? You've got the fundamentals right away. It moves, it reads on postulates and postulate configurations. Okay, now let's examine these various moves of an E-meter in terms of the postulate configurations. The easiest way we can do this is to put up our old friends A and B, with A operating on the postulate X and B operating on the postulate 1 minus Y. And between them they would have this barrier, where their two postulates are in opposition, and there would be the barrier. You remember this example that we used in the previous lecture? We'll resurrect this and use it again. Now, supposing this situation had existed sometime in the person's past, and the person and the I had been overwhelmed in the game, right? And it happened sometime in the past, and you are running this as an incident in the now. You follow what we've got. Well, you've got the pre-clear on the cans, and he was I, say, and he was in this game, and he was running the ex-bicycler, and his opponent was running a 1-minus-wide bicycler, and I lost the game and got overwhelmed. And he's connected up the cans, and you're going to run him through this incident of the overwhelm. Now, what sort of needle manifestations can we expect to see? All right. Now, we'll assume that this guy's in pretty good nick. He's in pretty good case shape. So the first thing you would see would be a floating needle. That means that there's no postulates in his field at all. There, he's just sitting idling at rest. That's all that a floating needle means. The person hasn't got any postulates out, and there isn't any, so therefore there's no opposition postulates. He's just sitting at rest. And when the spiritual being is at rest, you will see a floating needle. When he's really at rest, and you don't see this until you get to the top of level 3 in Tron, when a person gets to the top of level 3, you'll see a floating needle on a skin galvanometer that you've never seen before in your life. That thing's really going to float. You know, it would take an express train going through the auditing room to do anything about that float. It's a real floating needle, you know. But you won't see that until you get the person to the top of level 3. And that's one of the indicators, by the way, that a person has achieved the top of level 3, is that they have an absolutely superb floating needle that takes one hell of a lot to shift it. So that's just a note in passing. So we'll say this guy's in pretty good nick. He may not be at the top of level 3, but he's got a pretty good floating needle. There it is, it's floating. So you ask him to recall this incident. Now, as he says, okay, he starts to think about it. Now, the first thing you see is a slight tightening of the float. Now, it's the very first indication that he's approaching an area of charge, is that the floating needle begins to narrow, begins to tighten. You get a tightening of the float. Now, that's the very first sign, is tightening of the float, of the floating needle there, and it's immediately followed by the fall. You'll see the fall. Now the fall is quite a characteristic, the first of our characteristic reads is the float. I've just given that, the floating needle. I don't have to define it, it's defined in all of the textbooks there. The needle is little, it's just floating. There it is, it's just floating. The fall, the needle falls away to the left, and it's characteristic of the person becoming aware of the posture of the posture. First of all, he's becoming aware of the postulate barrier, the barrier out there, the conflict between the postulate and the opposition postulate. He's first becoming aware of it. He comprehends it, he sees it, and he looks at it, and you see the needle fall. He says, right, it's almost as if he's running a flag up saying, ah, game, needle falls. The fall is a realization more than anything else. It can be a discharge, it can be a discharge of tension. It's a realization, a discharge. The fall is a very healthy needle movement. The fall is very healthy. It means the charge is coming off the case. Realization, understanding is occurring, complementary postulates are occurring, realization is occurring, the person spotted what is happening. All these things will cause a fall. Get it? So the first thing is the tightening of the float, then the fall. So you direct his attention now more to the incident. You say, right, pick up the incident, and the fall now stops. The little series of falls that you saw stop, and he starts to put his attention on the incident. Then you go into the next point, needle movement, which is the rise. This is the rise, is the next most important needle movement, or it's the next needle movement in the set. Now what's happening here is that he's beginning to get into the engram. He's becoming aware of this barrier, and he's beginning to realise it's moving towards him, and he can't do much about it. He's trying his hardest. He's picking it up. He's got the getting the engram, and he's realizing that this barrier's moving towards him, and there's things happening now that he doesn't, you know, he's not completely happy with. The falls have stopped, you see. He's going into he's going into an area where he can't quite face it. He can't quite confront it. He's going into a bit of a no confront here. See that? And the effect is the rising needle. That's the rise. Now, it's a general principle in therapy that that any auditor worth his salt never lets a needle rise very far before he does something about it, because I can tell you, you let a rise go on for too long, and you can just lose your prickler. He's gone, mate. He just goes completely unconscious. He's gone. He can just rise his way straight into anything. So the good auditor will only let a rise go on a little way, and he'll say, "What's happening?" And you'll drag, get him back in, and you'll see the needle fall again. And you hang on to him and keep a close rein on the PC. So that's just a little tip if you're using a meter. Never let the riser go on for too long. But let it go on a little while. But just keep your eye on it. If it keeps on rising, say, "What's going on?" And he'll say, I don't care, I didn't like that very much. He starts to talk about the incident, and then you'll see the falls again as he starts to confront the thing and look at the thing and starts to come to grips with it again. But anyway, that's the rise. So that's the third of our needle movements, is the rise. Get the rising needle. And it's essentially that there's it's a sign of an approaching overwhelm. There's something you can't handle here. The rise is not a happy needle movement. It's not a happy needle movement. That's why you see an auditor in session should keep his eye on a rising needle. You should watch on a rising needle. It means the PC is about to be overwhelmed by something. And if you don't do something about it, he's gonna be overwhelmed. And maybe he's going to go in a direction you don't want him to go in. In other words, you're losing your PC. He's going when that needle is rising. So anyway, you let him go, and you get the rising needle. And as he approaches the barrier, shall we say, he gets closer and closer into the incident, and he gets right in there, and he starts to get into there and starts to approach the overwhelm, the point in the incident where he got into the barrier. You know, remember that we talked about this barrier? Now, what happens to the needle as he starts to come up against the IP barrier? Now, this is where we get into the very interesting point of needle motion here. And this is the something that they never quite, Ron never did get quite right in Scientology. He got close to it, but he didn't quite get it right. And he made some awful errors in this area, but he was completely excused because he didn't understand the IP state and he didn't understand the postulate configuration. So again, he's to be excused. In general, he got needle movements right, but he did make some errors in this area of the IP barrier. He made some mistakes in that area, but we're not going to make them. Now, as a person comes up against the IP barrier, remember I said he goes into confusion. Now, he starts to snap from a postulate to its negative at random. Do you remember me saying that? That's the first sign that he's coming up against the boundary condition. Well, there's a characteristic needle motion that goes as the person hits this boundary condition and starts to snap from postulate to negative at random, and that is the rock slam. The needle goes into this characteristic zigzag motion. It's quite characteristic. When you've ever seen one, you never miss it, you never forget it. It's the most dramatic of all needle motions. The needle goes to a position, stays there for a second, then flies off, takes another position on the dial, stays there for a moment or a couple of moments, and then off it goes again, shoots across the dial, sticks in another position, and shoots across the dial and sticks in another position. Well, that's the person snapping at random between a postulate and its negative. Now, that is the rock slam. That is the total significance of the rock slam. It's a confusion read. It's a dispersal read. Call it that if you like to call it. But it actually belongs at that point where the person is a, in terms of postulate, the person is snapping from one postulate, from a postulate to its negatives at random. Not in an orderly manner, but highly at random. They're being blown about like a twig in a storm as they come up against this IP barrier. The tremendous area of confusion here, of all these particles bonding and so forth, all this bonding of particles and IPs being generated at the barrier, and the person's getting mixed up in all this confusion, and he feels the confusion, and it shows on the meter as the rock slam. Now that is the total significance of a rock slam. Rock slam's got nothing to do with overt acts, got nothing to do with ill repute of doing disrespectable things or disreputable things, or all sorts of lies have been told about the rock slam, but that hasn't got anything to do with the rock slam. The rock slam is simply this read, this characteristic read that the person gets when they're right up against the IP barrier in games play, and they begin to be influenced by the barrier there, by the barrier of TIPM, and their attention is snapping between a postulate and its negative, and it's the first sign, it's the first indicator that they're right up against the barrier, that overwhelm is almost upon them. They begin to be badly influenced by the opponent's postulate, because their own postulate is snapping from positive to negative at random. Now that is the rock slam. It's the most violent of all the e-meter reads, and that is its precise. That is, I've now given you precisely its nature and what causes it, and it has no other reason. There's nothing else that will cause a rock slam but what I've just told you. That's the only reason for a rock slam on an e-meter. When you see the rock slam, that is what's happening. Now, often you see a rock slam on a meter, and the pre-clear, the person can't explain the rock slam. Well, that's simply because they're not using the confusion. They're in a confusion, but they don't know they're in a confusion. The confusion can be so intense that the person simply blots it out of their psyche. They just simply put no postulate against the confusion to defend themselves against it. So you see this violent rock slam on the meter, and you say, what's happening? And they say, nothing. And you're looking at your meter, it's going absolutely berserk with a rock slam. Well, know that. Don't. PC says, nothing. Nothing's happening. There's the meter saying, rock slam. Okay, well, what's happening is you've got a not-is rock slam there. So he's right up against this barrier, and he's saying, there's nothing there. So he's not issing it. But nevertheless, the meter's telling the truth. That's where he is. He's right up against, hard up against the barrier. He's snapping from a postulate to its negative. And he doesn't know he's doing it. He's just simply not is the whole works. The whole thing is above his level of experience. He can't confront it. He can't handle it. But another time, you'll see the rock slam, and you'll say to the person, what's happening? And say, oh, gee, I feel sort of confused. Yeah, whoa. And he'll explain what's happening. He isn't the confusion. He's experiencing the confusion. He's handling the confusion. But he'll still get the rock slam. Now, as you move on, as the person moves closer and closer to the IP barrier, to the TIPM, there, remember I said he goes out of the confusion and goes into a pulse. Now, as he moves out of the confusion, what you see is the rock slam dies down and becomes a more orderly movement. Instead of it being a random movement from one side of the meter to the other, jerking, the needle goes from one side of the meter to the other side of the meter and then back again, and you begin to see that it's now beginning to pulse. The needle goes from a rock slam to what is called a pulse needle. Now, in Scientology, they had various names for this. I've heard it, the most common name was a theta bop. A theta bop, that's a fast pulsing needle, and also it's known as a stage 4. Ron used to call it, sometimes he has been known to call it a stage 4, where the needle goes up, down, quite slowly. So it was never properly distinguished or identified in Scientology, this pulse needle, but it was recorded. Ron had it under those two names. But nevertheless, it's a pulse read, and it's the read that comes, that the person gets into when they've gone through the when they've gone through the confusion, and they're just before they go into the IP proper, they go into the pulse read. You'll see this quite characteristic movement on the needle where they pulse. Needle goes up, sticks, down, sticks, up, sticks, down, sticks, up, stick, down, stick. And it can be as fast as that, or faster, or slower. The pulse can vary in its velocity. But it's always, it's quite a regular regular movement. There's nothing jerky about it. It's quite regular. Can either be fast or slow or moderate. But there's the pulse read. It's a very transient read. It's very transient. Sometimes it's if it's a fast moving engram that you were running there, you'd have to have, if you took your eye off the meter, you'd miss the pulse. The person would go into the confusion through the pulse and out through the other side, and you'd miss it. Other times you see the preclear sitting there pulsing quite happily, you know. Well, not happily, but he's pulsing. Now, the preclear at the point where the needle's pulsing is rarely, if ever, aware of what's happening. You ask what's happening, he doesn't know anything about it. He'll say, oh, I feel a bit woozy, you know. And he goes very silent, very thoughtful, and but there's the needle going pulse, 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 pulse. And the whole thing's usually well above his awareness level. At that point, he's quite anatene, he's quite woozy when he's in the pulse needle. Right, that is the pulse needle movement. That is the fifth one of our characteristic needle movements. Remember, we had the floating needle, the falling needle, the rising needle, the rock slamming needle, now the pulsing needle. Now, as the person goes into the stops pulsing between the postulate and its negative, as the pulse speeds up there, you will see the pulse on the E-meter needle speed up, and it tends to get faster until it becomes quite a buzz, can become quite a buzz on the meter. Sometimes if you've got one of these meters that doesn't move, doesn't respond very quickly, you won't see the buzz. The needle will just get very sticky. But on a good meter that responds very quickly, you can actually see the needle buzzing. It'll buzz as if it's, you know, it's like a little bee buzzing there, you know. Definitely buzzing fast backwards and forwards, an enormously rapid pulse there. Now that's the indicator of the person's just about to go into the IP state. Take the pulse gets tinier and tinier and tinier and faster and faster and faster. It starts off with a wide slow pulse, and as the pulse on the meter gets smaller and smaller, it gets smaller and smaller and faster, and it gets smaller and smaller, faster, faster, smaller, smaller, faster, faster, smaller, smaller, faster, 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 buzz, 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 stop. The needle sticks, bang. Now the person's then moved into the IP. They're now in the IP state. They're now holding the postulate and its negative simultaneously. They're now in the motionlessness of the IP. You have a stuck needle. And that is the sixth. That is the sixth and the final needle, characteristic needle movement that you see on a skin galvanometer, is the stuck needle. It just sits there stuck. There it is, stuck. Not moving. Now, as the person moved through the incident, of course, the stick needle now, like they say, they come out through the other side of the engram, they come out through the other side of the barrier, that you would see all these movements in reverse. The person would come from the stuck to the buzz to the pulse, then there would be the rock slam, and then there would be the start, the rock slam would go into falls there, which is already should be fairly high, the needle, and start to go into falls, and then it would regain its float as the person got to the end of the, come out of the incident. The point from the stuck needle coming out the other side of the engram into the overwhelm is much faster. The person in good case shape would go from the point of stuck needle to the point of through the pulse to the rock slam, falls, into the float. They could do it in a matter of all a minute or two, maybe less than that if they're in good case shape. And you snap straight out of it, bang, in the present time, they float, they'll be back on the float again. Just depends on the state of case of the person. So there's your six characteristic needle motions. I'll go through them again for you. First, there is the floating needle. Second is the fall. Third is the rise. Fourth is the rock slam. Fifth is the pulse. And sixth is the stick. And so help me, that is all the needle motions there are. There aren't any more. Now, you might say, Dennis, how can you be sure that what you say is factual and true? And how do you know that you aren't imagining all this correlation between these needle motions and these postular configurations? Very, very simple. Because once a person understands these postular configurations, he regains his ability to manufacture these needle motions. In other words, that once a person works through level 5 and works through these IP barriers and so forth, he can actually create a stuck needle. He simply creates a postulate and it's negative. He mocks up both the postulate and it's negative simultaneously, and just holds both of them simultaneously, both at the same intensity, and the needle on an e-meter will stick rigid. Anyways, he can manufacture a stuck needle. Then when he takes his attention from one postulate to its negative, flip, 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 the e-meter will pulse, 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 in agreement with his postulate, as he's flipping his postulate from one side to the other. Then when he takes a postulate and snaps from a postulate to its negative at random, you will see a rock slam. You won't see a violent rock slam because he's doing it self-determinedly, but every time he changes his postulate, you'll see the flip, you'll see the needle take off there, you'll see a little tiny rock slam, manufacture the rock slam. And the fall, of course, he can manufacture for at any time. He can simply put his attention on something, take it off, then put it back on again. You'll see the fall. And there they are. And the rise, of course, he can just go into complementary postulates. Go into complementary postulates with everything around him, and you'll see a rising needle. That's a very easy one to manufacture. So the person in good case shape on trauma who's familiar at level 5 and familiar with these postulate configurations can manufacture at will all the needle manifestations that an e-meter is capable of producing, and he does them, and because he does them, he manufactures them in exactly the way I've said. It proves my point. You see that? It proves that what I say is true, because the person can manufacture them at will when he knows how to do it. And the method he uses to manufacture them is exactly the same as the way they are in the bank. You follow me? So that proves that what I say about these, the calls and what is the source of these e-meter movements, is exactly the same, exactly the way they are. If they were any different, you wouldn't be able to manufacture them consciously. You wouldn't be able to do it. But that is not the case. You can do it. You can manufacture them consciously by simply doing consciously what you do unconsciously in your reactor bank. Get it? So I'm on very, very firm ground here. I can prove it. I can prove what I'm saying, because a person can manufacture these reeds themselves, and they know how to do it. So it's the e-meter is now explored territory. It's completely explored territory. As I said in the write-up, that it's an optional piece of equipment, the e-meter, or the skin galvanometer, as it's more properly called. It's an optional piece of equipment. And unless a person is going to do these days, I mean, with Tron, we've really said goodbye to the e-meters. We really have. That there isn't any need for them anymore. We know all there is to know about e-meters. When you get up to level 5, as I say, you can personally create all the reads and put them on the meter. Say, what the hell? You know, all the magic, all the mystery's gone out of the e-meter now. With Tron, we know exactly what that bit of equipment measures and so forth. And we can really laugh when characters come along and say, oh, it's all to do with the way the hands sweat. Oh, yes, really? We really have a giggle at those boys now, we can. Because we can manufacture the reeds. When you manufacture the reeds, you can really call them a liar, can't you? That's what I said, that those, when I said early on, when these characters come along and talk about synapses and so forth, and hemispheres of the brain, and get all this mixed up with e-meter reads, and I called it garbage. I can prove it's garbage. I mean it sincerely, it's garbage. When I say that what they're talking is garbage, it is garbage, and I can prove it. Probably the only use of an e-meter in Tron would be to check out at the top of level 3. That's the only conceivable use I can think of an e-meter in Tron. It's for a person to say to themselves, well, now, have I really finished time breaking? Or am I deluding myself? Have I really time breaking everything in sight? Is there anything? Have I missed anything? And they should simply put themselves on the meter and do a bit of time breaking. And if they start to put themselves on the meter and start to do a bit of time breaking, and that needle starts taking off again, and that tone arm starts to move around again, well, they haven't finished. They haven't finished, because I tell you, when you finish level 3, you have a float. You have a float that would take the Russian army to knock you off that float. It's that sort of float, you know, when you're at the top of level 3. It's quite a floating needle you've got. It's quite a float. It's not necessarily a wide float. It might be a very narrow float, but it's a very definite float. It's a very definite float. And there's nothing you can think of all over your whole of your track, all over the whole of your known track, this lifetime, past lives, anybody else's lives, this universe, any universe, heaven, hell, earth, the lot, no matter what you think of, what you mock up, that needle just sits there and floats, man. It just floats. Now, when that happens, that's, you can say, well, I've got to the top of level 3. But if you start thinking of incidents, and you start to get little sticks on that needle, and little falls on that needle when you think of incidents, you haven't finished level 3. You haven't finished it. You haven't finished it, because you can knock yourself off that float. There's things in them, there are incidents that you haven't time broken. You should get in there. Get some of the emotions in them and time break the emotions out. Get some of the sensations in those incidents and time break the sensations. Time break the postulates. Get in there, get everything in that incident, you know. Get the lot. Remember I said in the write-up, Do it on a gradient scale. Take it a bit at a time. Get the important bits out, but then get the rest of it out. But you don't have to use a meter while you're running level 3. But it's a checkpoint at the end. It's a useful checkpoint. Checkpoint at the end. But look, even this isn't necessary. When the person's finished level 3, they know it. They know it. I tell you that when you finish level 3, it's just about impossible to time break anything, because there's nothing really there. You know, as soon as you get something out of your past to bring it into present time to time break it, it disappears. it just falls apart as soon as you touch it. You think, oh no, I'll just get my grandfather and get him into there, and I'll just time break grandfather. And where's grandfather gone? Oh dear, he was here a moment ago. Oh dear, the hell with grandfather, he's gone. Try grandmother. His grandmother. Oh, I've got a bit of grandmother's hat here. Oh, that's gone now. It's grandmother's hat. Yeah, I've got grandmother's hat. Grandmother. Oh, it's all gone. You know, it just goes on like this. And, you know, you're just looking at present time. You know, and your tone is high, you're feeling good about it, and you're thinking all over your past, and you keep thinking to yourself, is there anything else I can find to time break? You start getting down to the bottom spots and looking under the carpets and up the chimney, and you know, eventually you say to yourself, well, I must have finished level 3, simply because you can't find anything else to time break. And you can't, when you start dragging stuff out of the past and put it in the present, the time break, there's nothing there. Before you can time break it, it's gone. It just, you know, just handling it, it's gone. Now that's a sure sign that level 3 is starting to go flat. And that's, if you were to put yourself on a meter around about that time, you'd see that float. Now that's the time to leave level 3. But as I say, there could be a use of an e-meter check at that point. But again, it's not necessary. Because if you kept going with level 3, eventually you'd know it. You'd know it was flat. You'd know you'd finished it. Simply because it became virtually impossible to go on with the procedure. You say, well, I've got nothing to time break. Everything I touch just becomes nothing in my fingers. Everything I touch. And if you happen to be a trained auditor, you look around your books on Scientology, and every technique you can think of in Scientology, you think about it and try and run it on yourself, and it's all flat. Nothing moves, nothing does anything for you. No techniques you know of. You look up all your books and all the techniques, you dig out Ron's Creation of Human Ability and go through all the techniques in there and run them all, and it's all flatter than a flounder. There's nothing there. You know, nothing there at all. You say to yourself, well, I must be at the top of level 3. Now, that's the time to leave level 3, you know. That's the time to say, well, it's time I got onto level 4 now. Really, it's really the time I got to level 4. And that is the right time to leave level 3. You shouldn't leave level 3 before you get to that point. It's an error to go into level 4. Before you've reached that point in level 3. Now why is this? Why is it an error? Why is that an error? Well, there's a very, very old rule here that I mentioned in the write-up. This is the rule that says that you must always address the general before you address the particular. And if a person leaves level 3 very early, they're violating this rule, because level 3 is general time breaking of their past with the present. But once they go into level 4, they're going into time breaking of the 8 classes of overwhelm of the general to know goals package. Now, this is a particular class of things to time break. You see that? So they first should do the general, which is level 3, that's general time breaking, and only when they've exhausted that as far as they can possibly go through, they then go into the particular, which will be level 4, particular class of things to time break. Classes of the 8 classes of overwhelm of the to know ghost package. Now that is the technical reason. That is the technical reason why it's a mistake to leave level 3 before you've completely exhausted it. That's the technical reason why. Okay, well that wraps up the subject of the general subject of the E-meter. And but I've just been replaying it, and I realise there's two points that I've missed, which I'd like now to add for completeness sake. The first of these is I forgot to tell you how you can how a person can manufacture a floating needle. I told you how you can how a person in therapy can manufacture all the other reeds, all other 5 reeds, but I forgot to tell you how you can do a float. Well, a person can manufacture a floating needle. They would have to complete their therapy up to the top of level 3. Once they've got up to the top of level 3, all they would have to do at any time would be to simply put themselves on the meter, time break out that day's activities until there was nothing else available and nothing else around to time break, and then run a little RI, and while they were running the RI, or even before they started running the RI, they would see the float. The float would come back. The floating needle would come back. So that would be the thing that they would have. A person at level 3 plus would only have to just time break out the day's activities and run a little RI, and sometime during that sequence their float would reappear. The floating needle would come back. Now, when Ron said about the male clear reed and the female clear reed, 12,500 ohms for the male and 5,000 ohms for the female, I've had validation of this. This is, as far as I'm concerned, that his observation is correct. There's nothing in my experience which invalidates his observation. That I've only seen good floating needles in males at 12,500 ohms. In fact, when you're at the top of level 3, if you're a male at the top of level 3, when you've got a good floating needle, you can pretty well calibrate your meter against a 12,500 ohm resistor. You know, you're so close to 12,500 ohms that you know, you can just about calibrate calibrate your meter against it. Use yourself as a standard resistor, and as far as I'm concerned, it's exactly the same for the female at 5,000 ohms. So Ron's observations are correct there. I've got no personal experience to say that he was anything else but perfectly accurate when he gave those clear reads at 5,000 ohms resistance for the female and 12,500 ohms resistance for the male. So anyway, there is the way a person can generate a floating needle. Now the other tiny point I'd like to make is that while I was talking about the E-meter, discussing the reeds and so forth, I used the term rock slam for the fifth reed. You know, the confusion reed, I called it the rock slam. Now strictly speaking, in TROM, the term we use, a better term, a descriptive term for that reed, is a zigzag. It's a zigzag needle. It's a zigzag reed. That is a far, far more descriptive term than the word rock slam. The word rock slam only means something to people who know something about the history of Scientology circa 1960, when Ron Hubbard was researching a very obscure part of the time track called the rock cycle. And the rock slam is a reed that he thought was associated with that rock cycle, and so he called that reed the rock slam, and the word stuck, the name stuck. But these days it's a completely inappropriate name for that reed. A far better name is a zigzag reed, because that is descriptive. It is a zigzag. When you've ever seen one, that's the thing that comes to mind, is a zigzag. So where I view, if this material is ever published, goes into published form, the fifth reed is not, repeat, not to be called a rock slam reed. It is to be called a zigzag reed. Zigzag. So here are the six reeds, and I'll give them in the order of severity, which of course is the happens to be the sequence of 1 to 6. So here we go. The E-meter reads 1 to 6 in order of severity. 1 is the floating needle. Number 2 is the fall. Number 3 is the rise. Now, number 4 is the zigzag. Number 5 is the pulse. And number 6 is the stuck. Now, they are the complete set of E-meter reeds. They are the only reeds that we recognize in the field of Trom. Now, that is all I want to talk about on the subject of the E-meter. Up the subject of the E-meter, and the next thing I want to take up is to the practical aspect, the practical implications of the subject of the of TIPM and the subject of IPs in therapy, the practical aspects. The problem arises that do we have to incorporate any part of this technology in running the goals packages at level 5? Well, the broad general answer is no, we don't. A person could conceivably get there by running the goals packages exactly as I gave in the write-up. But they would probably get there, and I say probably, they would probably get there faster if they adopted the following procedure at the point where the subject of the IP started to become real to them. Now, this is an important proviso. There's no point in people mucking about with this IP procedure in therapy until it's real to them. There will come a time in their therapy when it will become real to them, and that is the time when they should start, if they want to, that is the time that they should start incorporating it in their general procedure of goals packing running at level 5. So a person may listen to this theory and so forth, but if the subject isn't real to them subjectively when they're running goals packages, if the idea of an IP and so forth is unreal to them, then they shouldn't attempt to incorporate it in their therapy at level 5. They should simply go on with the write-up and the instructions exactly as I gave them in the write-up. And sooner or later, the subject of IPs will become real to them. Then they should dig out this material and find out how to incorporate the IP material into their therapy. Now, do you understand that? It's important that you should grasp it. In other words, you shouldn't force the issue. You can't make this stuff real by reading about it. You've got to experience it. You've got to be at a case level. Your case, you've got to be ready for it before it means anything to you subjectively. It can mean a lot to you intellectually, but the fact it means something to you intellectually won't make it mean anything to you subjectively. It's got to mean, and until it means something to you subjectively, there's absolutely no point in incorporating it into your therapy at level 5 in the running of goals packages. Now, have I made the point clear? Okay, well, assuming the person gets to a point in level 5 and the subject of the IP starts to get very real to them, they start to see that these things do exist. Well, how would they incorporate the IP tech into level 5? Well, first of all, once the IP tech is incorporated into level 5, it becomes level 5 bracket IP end of bracket. It's a definite way of running the goals package, you see that. So we must classify it separately under a separate name. It becomes level 5 IP. It will be level 5A bracket IP, level 5B bracket IP, level 5C bracket IP. You get that? All of level 5 will become run using the IP deck once it becomes real to the person and they desire to use it. Okay? So first of all, the name, it's definitely, we name it differently. Now level 5, bracket, IP, end of bracket. Now here is the general principle. It's very, very simple. The addition to the therapy is, it's so minute that it's very, very easy to grasp. But we're running a goals package. Now here's the principle. You're running a goals package. Whenever you change your postulate, just before you change your postulate, you move through the IP barrier. That's number one. Then number two, just before you force the opponent to change his postulate, you drive him through the IP barrier. And that's it. There's the two rules. That's it. There's no other rules involved. They are the two rules. Now, let's take the general to no goals package and see how this would apply. I'll just give you briefly how it would work when the running of the first little bits of the general to no goals package at level 5A. You start in over there. Over the other side you have a person running a must be known postulate while you're sitting there holding a must know postulate. Right, now the first step is that you change your postulate to mustn't know, right? Well, just before you change it you have to go through the IP. So the level 5A IP would start with you at your end of the comm line going from must know into must know, mustn't know, must know, mustn't know, generally into the IP and out the other side of the IP into mustn't know. Get that? Then get the barrier in front of you. You'll see the barrier there then, and the barrier there, then you push the barrier across to the opponent. You'll see the barrier. It will start to show up. Then the IP barrier is there and you'll push it across to the opponent. And as it gets towards him, you force him to go through the IP barrier, and his postulate would then go from must be known into, he goes into must be known, mustn't be known, must be known, mustn't be known, and he goes into the IP and comes out the other side and goes into mustn't be known. Get that? And that's it. Then the procedure then repeats itself using the different postulates. You see, the next step would be exactly the same repetition of the procedure, but you're using different postulates. So there's only those two things involved in the use of the level 5 IP. So it's a minute change of technology at level 5. But it can speed up considerably the erasure of the goals packages. Once the IP material starts to get real to the person, once it's real to them, they should add this little tiny refinement to the package. And once they start to do this, within a very, very short time, they will become very, very familiar with the IPs, and they will get a tremendous familiarity with them, and they will understand and subjectively come to see that it really is, the whole subject is a toothless tiger, that there is nothing there, that it's just nothing there. They can sit there quite happily holding a postulate and it's negative simultaneously, doesn't mean anything to them. Where it will drive the compulsive game player insane, to them they can hold it at will, doesn't mean anything, it's a toothless tiger. You see that? At that level of awareness and understanding at level 5, where the person is working with the goals packages. So you when you start working with the IPs, you tend to start treating them with considerable respect and a certain amount of fear, but you rapidly lose all your respect for them. And finally, you just note them in passing, you know. Only occasionally do they produce any phenomena, and do they produce anything but a yawn. And then after that, of course, the whole level 5 starts to go flat, and the whole thing goes starts to erase. The whole of level 5 starts to erase. As the IP phenomena doesn't completely erase, won't completely erase until level 5 erases. The two are synonymous. The IP phenomena goes completely flat, completely meaningless, completely toothless tiger. But that is a precise point when all the goals packages erase and you finish with level 5. You get that? So that's how you would incorporate the IP technology into level 5. It's a very, very tiny modification of our procedure, and a very, very easy modification for the person to achieve at that level. By the way,